about some work. It's based on a couple of papers that we finished up recently, one with David Morrissey, Jonathan Kozacek, both at Triumph, and Arjit Menon at the University of Oregon. And possibly, if I get to it, a paper from a couple of years ago with David Morrissey, Chris Sigurdsson, and Sean Tulin. So as a by way of introduction, let me start with what you think of the sort of cosmological history of the universe. So typically, as we go back in time, we go through a series of phase transitions. So we have array of recombination, there's BBN, there's a QCD phase transition somewhere. Once we go past electroweak scales, we go through electroweak phase transition at high energies, we might end up with some unification physics and some gravity-related things at M Planck. So this is great, but unfortunately, observational evidence only goes until of temperatures of around a few MeV corresponding to measurements of primordial nucleons, primordial element abundances up to lithium 6 or 7. So essentially, this entire range in temperatures and energies is essentially free game. Anything can happen here. So in particular, I'll be talking about physics that happened just before BBN. And the physics, this physics has to do with the physics of moduli, which are a generic consequence of string theory. So string theories are typically written down in 10 or 11 dimensions. There's an associated 10 or 11 dimensional metric with them. And when you compactify down to our 4 dimensions, you end up with lots of these extra degrees of freedom that may manifest themselves at low energies as heavy scalar fields. So here, heavy, I mean heavy compared to everyday scales like the electroweak scale, but light, light from the title of my talk, compared to M Planck. So because they're light compared to M Planck, in the very early universe, they can be easily displaced from the minimum of the potential by something either comparable, by displacement comparable to M Planck or something less. And this leads to significant modifications of your cosmological history. And you can see that by looking at the equation of motion for this sort of field. So if you write down the sort of covariant equation of motion for phi, it looks like this. It's just a damped harmonic oscillator where H is a Hubble parameter. So it just sets the expansion of the universe. And if you solve it, this looks like this. Initially, the field is damped at its initial point, and it will start to oscillate eventually once this term starts to dominate. So you can average over the energy density in these oscillations to compute the energy density stored in these oscillations. And this energy density dilutes as the scale factor to minus 3. So this dilutes just like matter. The other important point is that because these moduli arise from the metric, their couplings to normal matter, such as to the electromagnetic field, are through Planck-suppressed operators. So that means any interactions are extremely weak. In particular, what I'll be concerned about is the decay rate of these moduli fields, which, based on this, goes something like the modulus mass to the third over M Planck. So this is extremely suppressed. So this means the moduli decay very late. I'm going to talk about it now. Yeah, so no, so I'm already at low energies. Everything's compactified. And the only sort of stringy physics that are left over at our scales are these moduli fields. So everything else is presumed at some higher scale. So from what I understand, there can be many moduli in principle, but at least one of them will be interesting for us based on this argument. So you can compute the mass matrix of these moduli. You can show that in general cases, the modulus mass is typically related to the scale of supersymmetry breaking, M3 halves. So this isn't entirely a sort of a bulletproof argument. There are some exceptions, such as in this paper. So this has to do with how you actually do the compactification. I'm not an expert on that sort of thing. But generally, you expect there's at least one modulus with a mass on the order of M3 halves. So because the modulus energy density dilutes as 8 to the minus 3, it will tend to dominate the energy content of the universe eventually. So if you plot the evolution of the energy densities as a function of time, your radiation density dilutes as 8 to the minus 4 So even if you start with a radiation-dominated universe and some subdominant component of the modulus, because it dilutes slower, eventually it will come to dominate, unless the initial point is very, very small. So eventually, in this moduli-dominated era, the modulus will decay very late because its interactions are suppressed by Planck mass. And you can compute the temperature at which this happens, which we call T reheat. So this is the point at which the modulus dumps all of its energy into the radiation bath, essentially. So, and this goes like m phi to the 3/2. For m phi around 100 GeV, this is around 5 MeV. At the same time, we also have a strong bound coming from BBN. You don't want to deposit any energy during the era of BBN or after, because this will screw up your predictions for primordial nucleosynthesis, which are successful. So this gives a bound on the reheat temperature, and as a consequence, this also gives you a bound on m3/2 if you believe this relation. So this points to a scale of around 100 GeV if you take into account BBN. Yeah. So this is a model-dependent question. So you can decay it either into either the gauge bosons, gauge sector stuff, or it depends on how it couples, basically. But that depends on how you compactify.
Are you decaying
it to
scattered model particles?
Yeah. So decay it into scattered model particles, so you heat the visible sector. I'll introduce new hidden sectors, so we'll also decay into those sectors as well. Exactly. This is why this is so low. This is why this happens just before BBN for these. And basically, obviously, you want to take m3/2 to be as low as possible because you want to have the best chance of being able to discover SUSY. So, question? So as an aside, the Higgs mass has been measured in 2012, finally. To be around 126 GeV. So generally in supersymmetry, this is kind of actually too heavy. In order to get this high mass, you need to have stop masses, which are the dominant contributions to its mass at one loop level, need to be very high. So this shows the mass of a Higgs is a function of the geometric mean of the stop masses. So you see that in order to get the right experimental value, your stops need to live at like 10 or 20 GeV. And this generally means that the other scalars in your theory, so the other super partners, need to be even heavier. So this again points to a scale of supersymmetry breaking on the order of something like 100 GeV. So we have these two completely unrelated things that are pointing to the scale. And this is kind of depressing because, you know, if the supersymmetry breaking scale is 100 GeV, you'll never discover it if that's where all the super partners live. Directly, anyway, at the LHC.
Never is a long time. Never is a long time.
In my lifetime. Yeah, so fortunately, there are mechanisms of supersymmetry breaking which give you a split spectrum where all the scalar particles are at around the supersymmetry breaking scale, while the gauge genus is oppressed relative to the scale by a loop factor. So, in particular, I'll be talking mostly about this anomaly mediated supersymmetry breaking scenario where the prediction is that the Wino mass is the smallest one. So, the Wino is the superpartner of the weak triplet gauge bosons. So this means that the Wino is your lightest supersymmetric particle. If it's stable, it's your dark matter candidate. So this is an interesting dark matter candidate because it annihilates really well. So the dominant annihilation mode is into W plus, W minus, and this rate is something like 10 to minus 24 centimeters cubed per second. So remember the normal thermal Wimp miracle value is 3 times 10 to minus 26. So this is way too fast. So this means that if the Wino mass is not heavy, so less than 2.8 TeV, this will in general underproduce the dark matter. So this can't account for all of dark matter. Unfortunately, the non-thermal moduli decay scenario gives us a solution. So when you produce these Winos non-thermally, the abundance gets modified, and it gets modified in the following way. So this is the freeze-out, normal freeze-out abundance, which would be too low otherwise. It gets enhanced by a factor of 1 over reheat temperature. So this is the normal freeze-out temperature. So this is something large compared to T reheat. So this abundance gets boosted. So even if your abundance is too small originally, it gets boosted by this low reheat temperature. So what it looks like in terms of co-moving number densities, you start off with a moduli dominated universe. It goes through reheating, dumping energy into radiation, and producing WeNOs, which then, once you produce enough, they'll re-annihilate to the correct abundance, and you end up with the correct amount for WeNO masses that are not crazy heavy. So the plot here shows the same thing, but in the entire parameter space, with the WeNO mass on the x-axis, the reheat temperature on the y-axis, the contours are contours of abundance. This thick contour corresponding to 0.12 is where the WeNO saturates the cold dark matter abundance that's measured. So you can do this for reasonable WeNO masses below a TeV. So this is sort of a nice scenario because it gives you superpartners at scales accessible to colliders. Unfortunately, this large annihilation rate comes to buy you back because they continue annihilating in the present universe, and you get very large indirect detection signals, both from lines which proceed through diagonals like this, even though this is loop suppressed relative to the tree level, which are no tree level processes to gamma gamma. But because the annihilation rate is so large, even the even a loop suppression gives you something that you can observe in principle. And you also get continuum gammas from final state radiation, hadronization, stuff like that. So very, very strong limits from Hess and Fermi that came out last year. So this plot shows these limits. So you have the WeNO mass on the x-axis, the annihilation rate into two photons. The red curve is the annihilation rate into photons for the WeNO. This peak corresponds to Sommerfeld enhancement, where the WeNOs are heavy enough that the W that's getting exchanged is essentially massless, and they can form a sort of a quasi-bound state, and the annihilation rate gets enhanced. So this happens at around 2.8 or something TeV. So these jagged lines, this is the limit from Fermi for two different colors correspond to different traces of dark matter profiles. This is the limit from Hess. There's a gap because Fermi doesn't measure higher than a 300 GeV or something for gamma rays. Okay. Yeah. So at least when I was making this plot, that was the case. Yeah, it only goes to 300. At least these are the limits from this paper from 2013. They might have updated them. I'm not sure. Anyway, this is just an illustration of the kind of limits that you get if you assume that the WeNO makes up all of dark matter. So the point is that regardless of the profile you choose for your dark matter, this scenario is robustly excluded. And I'm using the lines here because the spectral, it's easy to propagate photons from the galactic center. But in the further analysis, I'll use continuum spectra because exactly you don't have this gap here. And you get actually really strong constraints from a continuum as well. Right. So these constraints imply that the WeNO can't make up all of dark matter. And remember that our abundance is dependent on the reheat temperature, which in turn is dependent on the modulus mass, which is connected to the scale of supersymmetry breaking. So we can translate the indirect detection of limits into limits on the scale of supersymmetry breaking. So this is shown here as a function of the WeNO mass. You have m3 halves or on the y-axis. This purple band, this purple line, corresponds to the continuum limit on the WeNO annihilation rate. So above this line, you're OK. Below is ruled out. So the reason why you're OK above this line is because for higher m3 halves correspond to higher reheat temperatures corresponding to less WeNO abundance. So that improves the constraints. Or rather, it makes them weaker because you're left with less WeNOs to annihilate. At the same time, the anomaly-mediated scenario predicts what the WeNO mass should be, what it should be in terms of m3 halves, or equivalently, it tells you what m3 halves should be in terms of WeNO mass, which corresponds to this yellow line right here. And the point is that these two bands don't overlap at all. So there's something like a two-order magnitude discrepancy here. So this is problematic because we really sort of like this scenario because it gives you access to something to see in colliders and a good, interesting dark matter candidate that's easy, easy to look for, well, too easy to look for. So this has been pointed out in these nice papers from 2013. So our goal with this paper was to essentially try to see how can you extend the MSSM in order to solve this problem. And the solutions, sort of some of the solutions are pretty obvious. You essentially need to get rid of the WeNo so it doesn't cause you these indirect detection problems in the late universe. So what you can do is introduce a new dark matter candidate that's lighter so the WeNo can decay into it. So this is what we'll do in the first part of the talk. We'll just introduce some new hidden sectors to do this. Another option is to make your dark matter asymmetric, so the final state annihilations are suppressed by the asymmetry. And there are also other options that I won't discuss, such as R-parity violation, which will allow the WeNo to decay. So in this case, you need some other dark matter candidate, such as axions. Or you can dilute the WeNo component. Again, this will allow lower final late-time annihilation rates, or possibly something that we haven't thought of. So let me start with the sort of the simplest possible thing we can do is by just add a new U1 hidden sector to the MSSM. So it doesn't have to be an all mediation, but so we want essentially we're considering the case where the dark matter is mostly WeNo. Yeah. So the thing is, an all mediation gives you a WeNo LSP. If you have, really, this all should say anomaly like, anomaly mediation like spectrum. If you have Higgsino LSP or BeNo LSP, their annihilation rates are too slow. You tend to overproduce dark matter. So that's why we're interested in AMSB. But that's not the only way to generate this kind of spectra. Anyway, so to let's add a new U1 prime to our MSSM. This looks like just a normal MSSM superpotential. Then you add a kinetic mixing with a new gauge boson superfield and a couple of Higgs fields to break the new U1 symmetry because you don't want any new long-range forces. So this kinetic mixing will allow the WeNo to decay to the hidden sector into a gauge boson and the lightest neutralino in the hidden sector. So this will solve our problem, hopefully. Of course, this model is incomplete because you have to explain where this hidden mixing comes from. And this comes from integrating out particles that are charged in both the hidden U1 symmetry and the MSSM. So this kinetic mixing parameter, which will be important, is typically some loop-suppressed product of couplings. So it's a number of something like 10 to minus 2, 10 to minus 4, or smaller depending on whether this is allowed or how big these couplings are. And the dominant coupling of the hidden sectors is through this vector portal, which is proportional to the electric charge and the kinetic mixing. Okay, so even in this minimal supersymmetric model, you end up with a whole bunch of states. So you get this new hidden vector. You get a couple of Higgs states, CP even Higgs states, CP odd state, and you get three neutralinos. So one from the vector boson, from the gauge boson superfield, and two from the Higgses. And we consider cases where MX can be sort of on the order of GV. So this is a light hidden sector. What do you mean? There are chiral fields that are just charged under a U1 prime. So this is essentially a copy of the MSSM Higgs sector, except these are not doublets. You just, Anyway, so this sort of vector portal idea has been extremely well studied. There are many ways to look for it. So this plot here sort of summarizes constraints from a few years ago. So you have a hidden vector mass on the x-axis, the kinetic mixing parameter on the y-axis. So this is what I called mx on the previous slide. You can look for it in fixed target experiments, in beam dumps, in Fleury factory searches. So these are all sort of regions that are excluded by these kind of searches. So this is sort of a slightly outdated plot. There's been some recently very strong limits from Babar. And they are around here. So this is something that's very actively looked for. The thing is, so these limits are for essentially for processes where Vx, your hidden vector boson, decays back into the static model. You can also look for friends of X. So as I showed in the previous slide, this hidden vector boson comes with an entourage of other particles, typically. So you can look for these particles as well, coupling to X, such as these dark Higgses, dark matter. A lot of this work has been done. No, it's actually, that's one of the problems when you do cosmology with this model. In supersymmetry, the Higgs mass has to be less than the vector mass. So this is the same problem, but you have it. Yeah, so. Yeah, probably. So you end up with the coupling of this hidden Higgs to the MSSM will be through sort of D-term mixing that comes from this kinetic mixing. I don't remember if it's suppressed any more than it might be. Oh yeah. Okay. So the way it works is so you have the D-term mixing will be proportional to the epsilon. But you're also essentially mixing with the standard model Higgs, which is 125 GeV. Okay. Yeah, that's probably a constraint.
There was a sensitive search done for that.
Okay. Yeah, I wasn't aware of it, but yeah, that's a good point. The reason I'm showing you this is to show that I'll basically to show the region of parameter space I'll be concerned about. So I'll be talking about masses of MX of around a GeV and epsilons of around 10 to minus 4, conveniently in the not excluded region. So hopefully that extra long search doesn't.
Some of the Higgs goes into that region, but
okay.
It depends whether this extra Higgs could decay to
Yeah, so now you can implement your non-thermal Wimp miracle in this hidden sector. The way you do this is your lightest hidden neutralino just annihilates into on-shell vector bosons, hidden vector bosons through just a T-channel process like this. So this plot shows the parameter space, so M3 halves, so a supersymmetry breaking scale on the y-axis, and a parameter that controls the essentially the mass of a lightest neutralino. So the red contours are contours of the abundance. So this contour, the red contour 0.12, corresponds to saturating the abundance. And these gray contours are contours of mass. So you know, for reasonable values of parameters, you can always find a model that saturates your dark matter abundance for masses of around like between 1 and 5 GeV.
What do you call it, the miracle?
I'm sorry, no. Okay, so this is not something I invented.
It was a miracle at one point.
Yeah.
No.
This is a non-thermal Wimp miracle. Yeah, this is a different miracle from 2009. So this is a non-thermal Wimp miracle. This is completely different, much more miraculous, by the way. Anyway. Anyway, so you annihilate into these on-shell vector bosons. Unfortunately, or fortunately, they proceed and they decay back to the standard model through this vector mixing coupling promptly. So they decay right away back to the standard model. You end up with essentially the same indirect detection constraints because the final state products, they either decay into photons or they hadronize, you get a continuum spectrum from these photons. You also get a line. Well, I went backwards. Sorry. Somehow, like three slides.
Right?
Huh? Yeah, exactly. So that was a point. So you move the annihilation products lower into energy, and you hope that you evade the constraints. But this turns out to be not the case, which is what I show here essentially. So here's the constraint plot for this model. We have a hidden gauge coupling on the y-axis. It sets how fast the annihilations happen. And M3 halves is scale supersymmetry breaking on the x-axis. So the green regions are excluded by Fermi. The blue regions are excluded by Comptel. So Comptel was another gamma ray observatory that ran from 91 to 2000, I think. So they go down to lower energies, much lower energies, which is why this becomes important. So the Fermi limits cut out here because they have some, I don't remember what the lower bound on the Fermi fluxes is in energy, but you get excluded by Comptel anyway. Okay, so, yeah. So this is an overlap between Fermi and Comptel.
Okay.
So it's just very transparent.
So looks green, but okay. The Comptel.
Yeah, it is a little confusing.
From the gray region up to that.
Region. Yeah, except for this little blip here, which is white. This is the open parameter space.
Okay.
So that's not good. So there's actually a constraint from CMB as well because annihilation is through. I think it's above 30 MeV. I don't remember what the upper bound is.
And is it a line search or just total flux?
So this is all continuum results. We don't compute lines. Lines are small. And this gray band roughly corresponds to these fixed target experiments that I've shown a couple of slides ago. Essentially, if you go too light, you're excluded by them. You also have exclusions coming from the CMB. So if you annihilate, you deposit energy into the plasma during the CMB error during your combination, this alters your spectrum. So there's a limit on how much energy you can deposit. There's an uncertainty here that depends on the efficiency of this energy deposition. If you take it to be perfectly efficient, even this tiny little region is ruled out. So you can play with the parameters of a model, you can try to make this region bigger, but the point is that this doesn't work so well as you would want to. So the next thing to try is endow dark matter with some sort of an asymmetry. So with the hope being that at late times, the dark matter is very asymmetric, it can't find another thing to annihilate with. So the final state annihilations are extremely suppressed. So to do this, you need to have some sort of a charge for your dark matter. So this forces you to have a sort of a new, you have to add another superfield Y, which contains both a complex scalar and a fermion. You also have another requirement, it has to annihilate very efficiently. So you introduce some hidden gauge interactions. So for this, we reuse this U1 sector we've introduced in the previous few slides. The cosmological evolution of it in this case looks something like this. So again, co-moving densities on the y-axis, time variable on the x-axis. You start out producing roughly the same amounts of dark matter and anti-dark matter. There's a slight production asymmetry, so you produce slightly less dark matter or anti-dark matter than dark matter. And eventually, all of the dark matter, anti-dark matter, annihilates away. You're left only with the dark matter. So this is a very extreme case where you're essentially left with no anti-dark matter. But in reality, this will do something like this, and you end up with some sort of finite, non-zero component of anti-dark matter.
Can I ask a question?
Of course.
Is the synergy somehow related to the variance synergy?
This will be, if I get to it, this will be the last third of my talk. So in this context, we're just trying to solve the sort of a moduli induced LSP problem. So we're not specifying where this asymmetry comes from and whether it's related to the Baryon asymmetry. But the last, if I get to the last part of a talk, then this will be exactly a model that connects the asymmetry in dark matter and the asymmetry in baryons.
And what is
this is just a number I put in by hand. Yeah, so this is sort of a phenomenological parameter that I put in by hand. So it's being vague on purpose because we just wanted to show an example of how you can solve this problem. And then you can do model building on top of that to generate this asymmetry if you want. Okay, so constraints, as I just mentioned, in reality, asymmetric dark matter is never perfectly asymmetric. You have some component of anti-dark matter left over. So you still have indirect detection constraints in particular. So here's the expression for the constraint from CMB. So this is a limit on the cross-section over the mass. So these R's are essentially the fractional amount of anti-dark matter left over. So if Ri is zero, this constraint goes away. So there's two components to dark matter because you're adding a new superfield. The superfield has both a scalar and a fermion component. So you have a scalar and a fermion dark matter. So that's one constraint, also indirect detection, but we find that these are comparable, so I'll just show the CMB.
Why are both the scalar and the fermion stable?
Well, they have a U1 charge and they're the lightest states. So the fermion is stable because it's the lightest fermion charge into the U1. Yeah, and the scalar can be stable because it can also be the lightest thing that's charged into the U1.
Maybe like
yeah. You need to.
Is the lifetime for that automatically long enough that it sort of does that?
No, definitely not. So this depends on the spectrum that you choose. So this is just a particular realization of this model that you consider. You can definitely make things stable and unstable. This is just the simplest thing that you can write down. So
it's
another.
So
they're very close. This is technically natural because of supersymmetry. The other reason why you don't want any lighter fermion, lighter than the fermion, lighter than the charged fermion, is because you also have all those neutralinos that I've introduced before, like insect neutralinos. So if one of those is lighter and something decays to it, it just becomes a dark matter, and you end up with the same problems that you've had before. So you really want sort of same indirect detection problems, because you're just back to the situation where you just have a pure U1 sector with neutralino, hidden sector dark matter. The other constraint comes from direct detection due to a light mediator. So in the next slide, I'll show results from Lux, Xenon, and CDMS. So these are all low mass searches. We'll be interested in masses that are sort of less than 10 GeV. So the reason why this constraint is so important is because if you look at the scattering rate, the cross section on nucleons, this cross-section is proportional to the inverse fourth power of your mediator mass. So if this mediator mass is very low, this just boosts the cross-section way up. So here are the limits. So x-axis is the dark matter mass, so roughly the average of the fermion and the scalar masses. This is the cross-section. The lines correspond to the bounds. Everything above them is excluded. These dotted lines correspond to this cross-section for different values of the parameter gx and epsilon. So you see that essentially everything, all the interesting parameter space above 6 GeV is basically excluded. We want to live somewhere here. The reason is that we don't want these couplings to be too small because at least this gx, for example, sets the annihilation rate. And remember, we want the annihilation rate to be efficient to deplete the asymmetry. So the upshot, I keep going backwards instead of forwards. The upshot is that scenario works without too much fine-tuning. So here I show a couple of different slices through a parameter space. So to answer your question, the asymmetry is essentially just put in by hand as a parameter in the differential equations that give you the abundance. If I get to it, I'll show how to explicitly generate this in particle physics. So here's this asymmetry parameter that determines, for very small asymmetry parameters, you end up with a very symmetric population of dark matter, so, which is what these gray lines are, vertical gray lines, so 0.95, meaning that a fraction of anti-dark matter, the dark matter is around 1, so for equal populations, basically. For very large asymmetry parameters, you end up with a very asymmetric dark matter. So this blue region is excluded by CMB. So if your dark matter population is symmetric at all, you're killed by CMB constraints because you just deposit too much energy during the CMB era. The These red lines are contrast of the abundance. So this one corresponds to this asymmetric dark matter making up all of the dark matter, green region excluded by the constraints in the previous slide from direct detection. So there's some lots of parameter space, and here's another slice. So this is for an asymmetry parameter somewhere in here, so you don't run into the CMB constraints as a function of the hidden gauge coupling. So again, there's tons of open parameter space. So these gray contours are contours of the mass. So for light dark matter of a few GeV, you can easily satisfy all constraints and get around the annihilation bounds at late times. Okay. So to summarize what we found so far is that, so we've tried to solve this modulo induced LSP problem by adding new abelian hidden sectors. So the symmetric dark matter case didn't really work because you ended up still with indirect detection constraints. The asymmetric case worked kind of well. You didn't have to fine tune anything. One common feature for these two scenarios is that in both cases you need a light vector, which comes with light scalars. So this is perhaps somewhat surprising because the LHC points to a split spectrum in the visible sector where the fermions are much heavier than all the other stuff. So the idea is maybe we should look for a model of a hidden sector where you can actually have also a split spectrum as well. So with heavy heavy scalars, and having a heavy Higgs also implies you have a heavy gauge boson in general, or a massless one, so depending on whether the symmetry is broken or non-broken. So the next task is to find a solution with a viable split sector.
Sorry, can you just go back and understand your left bottom left slide a little better? So, of course, so what's setting the annihilation cross-section?
GX and the mass of the vector.
Okay, so you're always in the region where pi is heavier than where the dark matter is heavier than the vector?
Yeah, exactly. So this is always on shell. This is never a 3S channel. Yeah. Okay, so we're looking for a hidden sector with a split spectrum. So this means is you want an unbroken gauge group. This means you can have an abelian hidden sector because if you want the neutralinos to be the dark matter, they have nothing to annihilate with because the hidden sector, abelian gauge genos don't have interactions with abelian gauge bosons. So you're forced to consider a non-abelian theory, an SUN, a hidden SUN basically. So this sort of models have been considered by these people before in a different context. In this case, the spectrum is just n squared minus one, non-confined gluons and some gluinos that get a mass from supersymmetry breaking. So this is a standard sort of AMSB form where you have supersymmetry breaking scale and some loop suppression. And this R is it's a model dependent number. So for example, in pure AMSB, it's something like 3N. Because this is an unbroken SUN, you can't write down a renormalizable coupling to the standard model, but you want it because the MSSM LSP needs to decay into the hidden sector. So you need to introduce some non-renormalizable interactions which come from integrating out some heavy fields that are charged both under the MSSM and the SUN. So these interactions, therefore, are very weak because they're occurring through non-renormalizable interactions. So this means the two sectors never thermalize. So they have their own different temperatures. Of the hidden gluons form their own radiation bath, which comprise a set of massless degrees of freedom. And you get bounds, of course, from that. So the bound from BBN on the number of extra massless degrees of freedom can be written in this way, in this theory. So it's proportional to essentially the number of gluons times CX over CV. So CX over CV, so are essentially the branching fraction of the modulus into the hidden and the visible sectors. This essentially determines the ratio of the temperatures in the two sectors. So in principle, you can get around this bound pretty like sort of trivially if you set CX really low. But in realistic moduli scenarios, these numbers aren't too different. So this ratio is typically like some 0.1, depending on the number of final states that the modulus has to decay into. So another feature of this non-abelian plasma is that the hidden gluons essentially remain kinetically coupled to the plasma, which is unlike what happens in baryons, which eventually decouple. So this, they remain coupled till even today, because you can essentially interact with the plasma through through super gauge interactions with, this is a gluon, and this is unsuppressed because the gluons are massless. So you have this plasma of dark matter and the thermal bath that are remaining kinetically coupled. These undergo acoustic oscillations, just like what happens in the baryon photon plasma in the early universe, except this happens till very late times. So you have these oscillating gravitational potentials from this dark matter, and this tends to alter your matter power spectrum. And you get very strong bounds in the amount of dark matter of this sort coming from matter power spectra. So this, so these people put a bound on the amount of dark matter that can be of this nature, and you can have at most 5%. So the only thing, so again, this means this model can't make up all of dark matter. So what you need to do is, last thing to check whether this can even be remotely true is you need to check whether you can generate an abundance that small, so less than 5%, which turns out to be tricky. So if you look at the abundance as a function of a gauge coupling, it has sort of distinct regions. So first thing to note is that, so this is one, where it saturates the dark matter abundance. Almost everywhere, it's more than one for all reasonable gauge couplings. So in order to get a small amount, less than 5%, which is required by the bound from matter power spectra, you need to again play with your parameters. You have to move into a sort of an unphysical, sort of extreme fine-tuned region of parameter space. So this model doesn't quite work. Yes. It's tiny. It's 10 to minus 61 GeV. Yeah. Is there a significant running? It's not coupling at zero, because that would mean it's non-perturbative. But yeah, so this has to be at the gluon scale, because this is a relevant momentum for the dark matter annihilations, roughly speaking. Okay, so let me summarize this part of the talk. So I've looked at the non-thermal wimp miracle at low re. Sorry, I'll take that back. These are not my words. This is the title of a paper from 2009 by, I think, Gordy Kane and friends. So don't blame it on me. So we looked at this late time decays of moduli, giving rise to a very low reheat temperature in the early universe. So the scenario in general overproduces dark matter unless you have a very large annihilation rate, in which case you get very strong constraints from late time annihilations from indirect detection. So we looked at several new extensions of EMSSM by introducing new gauge sectors. And this turned out to be sort of a big mess, because the only thing that seemed to work without any significant fine tuning is asymmetric dark matter. The other two possibilities, a symmetric hidden sector and non-abelian hidden sector, have serious problems. So of course there are possibilities that I mentioned at the beginning, which I have not discussed, such as R parity, which will allow your dark matter to decay. But again, in this case, you need some sort of an extra component for dark matter, such as axions. So since asymmetric dark matter works so well, I'm going to go back to it. And I'll talk about this cosmic coincidence, which may be just an accident, or it may be telling us something about the nature of dark matter and baryons. So because the abundance of dark matter and baryons is roughly on the same order, so again, this is either an accident or this is telling us that they might come from the same mechanism. So I'll talk about one of these mechanisms, which goes by the name of phylogenesis. I think Ross had an issue with the name because it's a combination of Greek and Latin. Somebody was, yeah. Anyway, so this comes from a time when it was fashionable to come up with silly names for your models. So, yeah, I've seen one of those, but that's really depressing. Yeah. So the goal is essentially to unify the production of dark matter and the Baryon asymmetry in one nice mechanism. I'll do it in pictures because once you actually go to implement it in supersymmetry, your field content sort of explodes and it's a big mess. So let me start with the typical baryogenesis introduction. To generate a Baryon asymmetry in the early universe, you have to fulfill the Sakharov conditions, which are B violation, C and CP violation, and some sort of out of equilibrium condition. So these you can typically do through model building. So typically this is the hardest thing to satisfy. Fortunately, moduli decays, because they happen so late in time, just at such a low temperature, these are far out of equilibrium. So we can use these to produce our Baryon asymmetry. Okay, so here's the mechanism. You start off with a moduli-dominated universe. The moduli decay just before BBN, or maybe a little earlier than that. They decay to a new baryon that we call X, producing symmetric densities. So you have densities on the y-axis of X and X bar. Again, carries baryon number. This happens because the moduli decays happen at such a low temperature. This occurs far out of equilibrium, even for X. These X's have couplings to visible baryons and to a hidden structure which contains dark matter. So they decay in the following fashion. So you decay to visible baryons, so quarks and antiquarks, producing slightly more baryons in the visible sector. And also you have decays to dark matter where you produce anti-dark matter and dark matter, slightly more anti-dark matter. So in this scenario, your dark matter carries anti-baryon numbers. So the dark matter will be the missing anti-baryon, so to speak. Again, so there's also there's a scalar and a fermion again, which is sort of reminiscent of the ADM scenario that I showed in the previous part of the talk. In the final step, the asymmetries annihilate away. And if these sectors don't talk to each other, the asymmetries remain frozen in to present day. So this is a scenario proposed in 2010 by these people, including my supervisor. So again, dark matter consists of two states, so a fermion and a scalar. And in order to get a correct abundance in this scenario, the masses of the dark matter must satisfy this relation. Yeah, far below. So this is, you know, moduli decays happen at tens of MeV, hundreds of MeV. So based on this ratio, you can predict what the sum of the masses must be. So the sum must be around 5 GeV. So again, we live in this very light dark matter, which will be consistent with our direct detection results. We also have some stability requirements to ensure that proton of the dark matter doesn't decay. So this gives you some inequalities that you must satisfy on the masses in the splitting. So this just forbids processes like proton decay or dark matter decay. Okay, I'm going to mostly skip this. So we can write down a superpotential to make this work. As I mentioned, it gets to be really messy.
Can I ask one question? I don't quite understand the idea behind saying, you know, I see this, you know, lambda dark matter versus lambda baryon as a factor of 5.
Yep.
Very mysterious. I'll expand it by asymmetric dark matter. And at the end of the day, you set the dark matter mass to 5. How is that an explanation of anything?
Yeah, I guess.
My explanation is
I guess it's not really an explanation, as more of a motivation to study a certain kind of model in a certain region of parameter space. But yeah, I agree.
But that same model could work no matter what the ratio was, right? If the ratio was kind of a sphere, I could still say the same word. In fact, I'm able to say the better word because then it's the TNV scale.
I will tell you why this horrendously complicated model is interesting. And it has to do with this operator, the transfer operator, which is a coupling between the X, which has baryon number 1, and this operator UDS, which allows it to decay to standard baryons. So this is a sort of so-called hyperon portal operator. Ignore all of this stuff for now. This XYY coupling is the coupling that gives you the decay into the hidden sector, into the dark matter. And you also, you have to implement the same things for asymmetric dark matter, so you need some sort of way for it to annihilate efficiently. So you introduce a new U1 prime with a kinetic mixing. So it's just the usual story that I described before. The asymmetry in this model you can actually compute. So the production asymmetry from the decays of EX, this is the same as what you have in leptogenesis or gut baryogenesis that occurs from the interference of Schie level and loop diagrams, and you can actually compute it in terms of the couplings and the masses in the theory to get some formula like this. So again, you get a whole bunch of states. In addition to all the U1 hidden sector stuff, you also have your dark matter, but there is a funny doubling of matter for technical reasons. So you need to deal with all of this if you want to make a sort of cosmologically consistent model. You need to make sure all this extra stuff either decays away or annihilates away efficiently, so it doesn't contribute to dark matter or screw up BBN or CMB. So there's some fairly strong requirements on what the relevant rates in this model must be, but in principle it can be satisfied because there are so many parameters. I'm running out of time, so I'm going to skip the cosmology, which is very similar to what I showed before. The interesting part of this model comes from this transfer operator, the XUDS operator. And this gives rise to a very interesting indirect detection signature called induced nucleon decay. So what can happen, you can have a scattering of a dark matter in the halo from a nucleon. So because dark matter carries antibaryon number, it can actually sort of annihilate away your nucleon, producing a meson and anti-dark matter. So in a detector, this looks like just like standard nucleon decay. Because you don't observe this, this is a meson, so you have a proton disappearing into a meson and missing energy. So in general, the dark matter and its scalar counterpart are not degenerate, so you have both upscattering and downscattering paths possible. So this will give rise to different final state kinematics. I'll show in the next slide. So the question is whether this is actually excluded by proton decay searches. So the current bounds are typically on the order of 10 to 33 years. So we can go ahead and compute the lifetime of a proton in the presence of its induced nucleon scattering. And you get some number, so this depends on sort of the cross-section for this process, as well as the local dark matter density. And for reasonable choice of parameters, this something like 10 to 32 years. So it's right in the ballpark that is probed by the current proton decay searches.
Does it have any other interactions aside from that induced decay?
Yeah, of course. So in the ADM case that I've showed in the previous part of the talk, there's an elastic direct detection. So you have a usual. Okay, so the quantum. Yes. Yeah. So you get. So this is an effective. So if you integrate everything out, it's going to be a dimension 7 operator that gives you gives rise to this induced nucleon decay, where this lambda IND is a function you can compute of masses in the full theory. So this corresponds to this rate that I estimated here corresponds to a choice of lambda of around a TeV.
Right, I guess one problem.
Yeah, for sure. So you can I'm not going to talk about it,
are
but
there just velocity scattering and there's a new bit or something like that?
Through this particular operator?
No, no.
Yeah. So yeah, there's a lot of stuff going on. I'm sorry. So you have your.
Is this a light pulse on the screen?
Yeah. Exactly. So this is a structure on top of a hidden U1 sector.
Right.
So there's a coupling. Through the vector portal.
Okay.
Of.
So you're gonna capture a buttload of those guys in the sun, right?
Yeah. So this has been investigated in a previous paper. I don't remember what the limits are, but I think you can make it work. Yeah, so there's an entire paper dedicated to.
So you don't disintegrate in the core of the sun.
Yeah, so you can heat things and.
The density shoots up pretty quickly. But you say it's
I mean, it's still a low rate compared to the
Yeah, there's definitely some capture on stars. I can pull up a paper if you want.
The sun part of the star is probably different from the sun.
Yeah. Yeah, so what I wanted to point out is that this rate for reasonable choice of parameters is something that's currently probed or has been probed. Mm-hmm. So, you know, why is this model not excluded? So the reason for that is that for standard nucleon decay, these experiments make very severe cuts because they look for a meson. For example, for K plus channel with a particular momentum, 340 MeV. So this means that, for example, in Super K, which is a water Cherenkov detector, you look for a fixed number of Cherenkov rings because you know that the K plus is coming out with a certain velocity. In IND, you can have much more energetic mesons coming out, so you can generate more Messier signals with more Cherenkov rings and more energy, essentially, in your detector. So these events, interesting events, could be missed due to experimental cuts. So in particular, so we can have both upscattering and downscattering. Upscattering is slightly less energetic, but you can still have a much more energetic event than just normal nucleon decay.
So
this has been checked, but it covers some of the parameter space, but not far from all of it. I'm not sure, but so this has been checked before I got on board. I don't remember, but I think basically we've talked to experimentalists about this, looking for this sort of signature, and they said that, you know, this is not really probed that well. So basically the ball is in the experimentalist score now. We've tried to convince him to look for this, but hasn't really worked out so far. So these interesting events can be missed due to these experimental analyses, not taking into account these more general kinematics. So let me summarize the halogenesis part. So you can construct a mechanism that unifies the production of dark matter and the barium asymmetry. It gets a little messy in supersymmetry. There's an interesting cosmological decay. But the whole motivation for this scenario is because of this induced nucleon decay signature, which would be interesting to look for. That being said, if induced nucleon decay is not found, halogenesis as a mechanism for baryon production, dark matter isn't ruled out. This just means this operator is too small. It has a different flavor structure. So again, yeah, this depends on the assumptions about the flavor structure of this operator. Include the overall part. So I've talked about moduli decays, which lead you to sort of interesting non-standard, non-thermal history in cosmology. Generally, dark matter produced in this way is either overabundant or runs into problems with indirect detection. So I've shown some models that attempt to fix this. It's not entirely trivial. The thing we did find to work was asymmetric dark matter, and that worked pretty well. The nice thing, asymmetric dark matter provides modulo Itais commons, kind of connection to baryogenesis. All right, that's it. Thank you.
must have calculated the spectrum of the Higgs sector, right? I mean, like, relative to the, to the dark vector mass.
Yep.
So, actually, spectrum one of the Higgs is lighter.
Yeah, it's a bit lighter. So, the thing there, so.
And then it leaves one, right?
Exactly. So, you have to make sure, you have to ensure that all the cosmological problems are solved, meaning that it decays fast enough. Yeah. So in the papers that I cited when I discussed this guy, the general constraints on these U1 prime sectors. So they've looked at various collider signatures where you can possibly have displaced vertices because this new hidden Higgs can, you know, travel macroscopic distances and be possibly detected. So this depends strongly on the mass of this Higgs, depending which alters what decay channels are open to it. But it can pretty easily be like light enough that it's long-lived on collider scales. So that's actually one of the strongest constraints when you construct a sort of a cosmologically consistent model for this, is to make sure this hidden Higgs decays fast enough, even like before BBN. Because if you want to make your
long range between
exactly. So this is. Yes. this slide?
Actually, no, the next. The modular decay.
Okay.
Yeah. Have people actually thought this through in real time model, or is it just a hand wavy argument about where pi should start? Because maybe I think, you know, maybe it really depends on what is the potential for pi, the potential is very steep.
Exactly. But okay, so the whole point is that
I could imagine a situation where pi would just want to start in
the Okay, so the lore, the moduli lore that I know, sadly I'm not a string theory, so I can't like write down a string theory and compactify it for you and find out what the five potential
five. Does anyone
Okay, so moduli stabilization, which is moduli stabilization. It's an entire industry. It's an entire industry to be able to stabilize moduli. I think in principle it's
but
been done for.
But let's forget about the stabilization format. I believe you can stabilize. Mm-hmm. But the particular issue of whether you can initiate this place at M Planck.
Okay, so this is it can be less than M Planck. This is just a upper bound. Obviously. So yeah, the idea is that moduli initially don't have a potential, so it corresponds to a flat direction of some sort. And it gets a potential through either non-perturbative effects with supersymmetry breaking. So this, you know, this statement that it gets a mass on the order of a supersymmetry breaking scale just corresponds to the fact that it gets a quadratic term in its potential from some Susie breaking effect.
So is the industry you're referring to mostly Gordy Kane or?
Well, his papers are, you know, he claims that he can construct an explicit model of G2 MSSM from like a Calabi-Yau compactification, but it's not done explicitly anywhere. I mean, like mathematicians and string theorists, yeah. But it's a problem. Yeah, here I've taken a very very phenomenological approach to moduli physics, sort of taking facts from string theory, loosely.
Folklore.
Yeah, sure.
Well, and just to correct on that, I mean, it's true that if you have foods which are, you know, which would be massless except for Susie breaking scale, they would expect this to happen.
Mm-hmm.
That I don't know that, well, I don't know how to, and I don't think anyone really knows how to say that's what we should expect to happen.
Yeah, so.
The simplest models have this property, but that's probably because those are the easiest ones.
Yeah, exactly. So, like, as I briefly mentioned, that there are some exceptions to how you actually do the compactification. You don't have to end up with moduli, but Gordy Kane will argue it's a generic feature.
I don't think there's going to be rational basis for saying that.
Okay, this is.
I thought we're supposed to be scientists.
Okay, well, I guess this is a motivation to think about non-thermal history, which is phenomenologically it's an okay possibility because we don't have probe anything above the BBN temperatures.
But I mean that's true. But I guess this whole discussion did depend in some detail on this on the mass correlation part of this particular non-thermal history.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I was trying to.
Okay. Yeah. So. So even if you do have moduli at masses that are much greater, for example, than M3 halves, in general they will have coupling. They will be able to decay to the gravitino, which is at M3 halves. And the gravitino, you can actually estimate that it also come to dominate the energy content of the universe before it decays, because its couplings are also gravitational, very weak. So you end up with the same problem as you do with moduli, because you're just, instead of moduli dominated problem, you have a gravitino dominated problem. So in some sense, it's a generic issue that you have to deal with. What's my name?